The fundamentals of his religion won't teach him to behave like this.
You're saying the fundamentals of Islam teach them to be
yes.
violent? That's very generalized, sir.
It is true, sir.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I don't think it's at all this, sir. If that was the case, Abdul Kalam, Zakir Khan, Muhammad Siraj, all these guys would be violent. I also think that modern Indian Muslims acknowledge whatever happened. And we've had people like AK Mohammed come on the show and talk about it. They don't look at themselves as any different from Indian Hindus.
For every KK Mohammed, I will show you at least 30 Muslim clerics who come on live TV every night on debate. They will say that Aurangzeb is our hero. Mahmud of Ghazni is our role model, whose voice carries more weight within the larger community.
You know whose voice carries the most weight? Muhammad Siraj and Muhammad Shami, who are the two key fast bowlers for India.
Your temple is being built, so Jai Shri Ram kehne mein kisko kya dikkat hai?
Mashallah.
Hazar baar bolo na.
I personally feel that if we attach whatever happened during the Islamic invasions to the modern day Muslim, it's the equivalent of saying all the white people in USA were slave owners. That country is suffering. I don't want the same to happen to my country. The history of Hinduism versus Islam in India. I know how controversial this title sounds. I know how controversial this thumbnail is. If you're a non-Hindu consuming this podcast, please watch the entire length of it, because this was actually a bit of a debate rather than just a one-way street in terms of conversation. I have immense respect for my guest today for being able to debate with me over the course of 2 hours. Personally, for me, this podcast is a representation of a lot of conversations that are happening in our country today. Lots of people feel that politics has suddenly converged with the history of our country. There's a lot of religious animosity in our country today, unfortunately. We have to be the voice of the nation. I have to do my job as a media professional. This is an uncomfortable conversation. It's a respectful but uncomfortable conversation. So I hope you consume the entire length of it. And I hope you understand the intention behind Team TRS's work. This is an epic conversation that I hope you'll enjoy. Another history deep dive on TRS, this time with Sandeep Balakrishna. How are you, sir?
I'm good. Thanks for having me here.
No, happy to speak with you, because you dislike our history textbooks as much as I dislike them. And as much as my audiences have disliked the history that we're taught in our education system. Mm-hmm. I literally haven't met a historian or a researcher on the show who doesn't agree with this opinion of mine. Are you in agreement?
Absolutely. Interesting you mentioned that, you know, do you dislike history textbooks as much as you or anyone in your audience dislikes? There's a reason for that. But just to state the blunt truth bluntly, these are not history textbooks, at least what have been prescribed for our school children all the way up to university, even postdoctoral level. These are not history textbooks. They are propaganda material.
Okay.
They are manuals for indoctrinating generations of Indian children.
You mean putting things inside people's heads so
yes.
that they grow into adults who believe a certain version of history?
Not just a certain version of history, although because it is history per se, it is not just one version of history. The design is to create certain generations of indoctrinated children who are so indoctrinated when they become adults that any alternate view, or even if the truth is staring at them in the face, they refuse to believe it.
Okay.
This has been the long-term project. And you have at least 2 or 3 generations of kids who have now become adults, including people of my age and even maybe 1 generation before me. So this has been accomplished by rigging our textbooks.
Okay. Would you like to be challenged today, or would you like to just open up?
Your wish.
Would you like to talk about the Mughal rule, or would you like to talk about the present day history textbooks where we began? because I think that's kind of the base layer of everything we've spoken about.
That, the history textbooks?
Yeah, like you said, you have a problem with how history has been written and shown to school children, which I completely agree with you upon. On so many fronts, the chapters were taught about, the way people like Alauddin Khilji have been depicted in our history textbooks. You need a movie like that Sanjay Leela Bhansali movie Padmavat to actually make you understand aspects of the truth about even the pre-Mughal rulers. And there was too much brutality that happened, which is not really mentioned in the history textbooks. There, I'm in full agreement with you. And I think we've spoken about this on the show to Vikram Sampath, I believe. And he said that there was a committee that was created in 1947 to write history textbooks for our education system. And people were picked very carefully for that committee. So anyone who glorified people like Veer Savarkar and few other names I've taken, which I can't remember, were not kept as a part of that committee. So therefore, again, the education we are being taught is a representation of a few humans who decided that this is the kind of education that India should get in the long
term.
The kind of history that in India should learn in the long term. The good news is that young people know this. Not just because of the show, but this is just general young consciousness. Because we have Wikipedia now. We have podcasts now. We have historians like yourself coming on the show. So people are understanding the truth. My biggest problem with this whole thing is Nalanda and Takshashila were destroyed, which for me hurts me the most because so much knowledge was destroyed with it. We don't even know what we don't know in terms of the knowledge that was destroyed. And it hurts when you hear stories like that library burnt for, and they say
3 months to 6 months or something.
So that library burnt for 6 months. You've lost all that forever. That's what hurts me the most. But what also kind of hurts me is that even our history textbooks instill a sense of self-doubt and low self-esteem in students when we should actually be talking about the Chola dynasty, the Ahom dynasty, other people who are part of the freedom struggle. Like, we highlight very few freedom fighters. There were so many freedom fighters that should be highlighted. We're not taught enough about the formation of Pakistan. We're not taught enough about general Indian history, even when it comes to your Chandragupta Maurya and Ashoka. When you're studying for a 10th standard exam in ICSE, you're only tested upon freedom fighters and a bit of civics. Why not give that 10th standard syllabus a revamp where we're teaching those 10th standard kids that go into the world outside school knowing that you're from the country that built the Chola Empire, that built the Ahom Empire, and all these pride instilling pieces.
This was designed the way I don't know what this generation reads, but even when I was growing up in my school and college textbooks, it was not so vicious as it is now. I studied in a state board.
Vicious?
No, this distortion.
Oh, okay.
It's not so vicious. So it was still okay. Our state board history syllabus was still really okay, but the NCERT, like you said, ICSE, CBSE, these books were atrocious. The formula was simple. Downplay or whitewash or distort the atrocities done during the Islamic period. And paint Hindus who resisted. They were all alien regimes, sir. Basically, it was ruled by foreigners. So when you talk about this, you know, Muslim back projection and all that, they were all invariably, they were all drawn from foreign blood. They were not Indians. But anyway, that's a separate thing. So instill a sense of contempt. And by painting people who resisted, Hindus who resisted these atrocities, paint them as rebels.
Like who?
Maharana Pratap.
You think he's painted as a rebel?
Of course he was.
Okay, I'll tell you what Maharana I know as Pratap. A 1993 born person. I don't look at him as a rebel, sir. And actually I have pride that Maharana Pratap is from my land.
Sure, but this is what textbooks have taught us.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
No.
Maharana Pratap was a rebel against Akbar.
I don't think it's at all this,
yes,
sir.
Yes.
No. Yes. Let's debate again.
Yes, there's nothing to debate.
My point
check out the history textbooks from 1974 till about 2000.
Okay. Just check it out. Okay, maybe here.
Maharana Pratap from Sisodia ancestry dynasty was a rebel who challenged the might of Akbar the Great.
Really?
These were the wordings, this variants thereof.
Like, this is the first time hearing this in my life, because all I've heard about Maharana Pratap was about his bravery, about stories related to him, and there's a certain sense of pride with all the legendary Rajput kings. Prithviraj Chauhan.
Sure. Read those textbooks, sir. These are not my words.
Okay, no, fair. Maybe you've seen something that I've not seen.
These are not my words. Shivaji was a mountain rat.
Those are the words used?
Yeah, mountain rat who dared to defy the might of Aurangzeb.
These are the words
These
used?
Are the words.
Really?
When I say distortions, the levels at which the distortions have been made, just two examples of such great, you know, kings who have been painted like this.
Why?
Why? Vote bank?
Break that down.
Yeah, vote bank. If you have to tell the truth about Islamic authorities, atrocities, right? The Congress party decided that if you tell those truths, it will offend the current Muslim community, of which we are the protectors, meaning we have the Muslim vote bank in our hand. So whitewash all those atrocities. Huh? Say that they were benevolent kings. They brought art and culture and building of monuments, architecture. They brought painting into India. They were patrons of music and dance. So downplay all their, whitewash all their atrocities. There is a wonderful book called Eminent Historians, Their Technology, Their Lying, Their Fraud, which was published in 1998 by a gentleman named Arun Shauri. He has an entire chapter which is simply a list. The whole chapter is just a list of all the major distortions in history introduced by the government. The title of the chapter is Shuddho Ashuddho. Meaning, this is our version. This is our distorted version, is the Shuddha version. What real history tells, has told so far, is the Ashuddho version, Ashuddha version. These are all chapters. He gives complete extracts from various textbooks, in both written by the state, central government, and other state governments.
So are you saying that in the year 2000, with the Vajpayee government, things changed?
Things began to change.
Okay.
Things began to change.
Okay. And they're still changing?
I think there's some new education policy which I have not read in full, but I believe a lot of reforms have been made in textbooks.
I hope history that the textbooks. New education policy doesn't instill hate in the history textbooks.
So this has been the whitewashed version. So how will a child become confident, have pride, like you said, in your own land, in your own culture?
Very capitalistic answer here is, I feel education has gone way beyond schools and colleges. Mm-hmm. And Ronnie Screwala told me this, who's running UpGrad.
Mm-hmm.
He said that now education is a lifelong process.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of education is based on self-education. Self, which is a representation of what you've done as well, sir.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you've dedicated your life to history,
mm-hmm.
despite being like an IT professional. Mm-hmm. And I've had countless brilliant minds like yourself on the show who have similar stories.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just out of the interest of a subject, deep dive.
Mm-hmm.
So even as thought leaders like yourself, or as podcasters like myself, all we can do is you lead the horses to the water source.
Mm-hmm.
Then it's for them to drink. There'll be people who'll agree with you, people who'll agree with me. There'll be people who won't agree with either of us,
mm-hmm.
and who'll draw some sort of a midpoint conclusion. But that's all we can do.
Mm-hmm.
Because somewhere, I don't have hopes from the traditional format of education in our country. I have hopes from the new education policy, but I've also heard that it's going to take 20 to 30 years for it to completely.
Yeah, things like education are by design, by its nature, they are generational.
Yeah.
See, so any change at that level has to, the good or the bad consequences will show themselves after a generation.
Yeah.
So that's the nature of the beast.
Yeah. I hear you. And we've had a lot of people speak about British colonialism and, you know, all its negative effects on the show. And I'm sure that the audience is also very aware by this point about everything wrong that the British has done. I know that even the government is very aware of this. Okay, and I want to actually deep dive into exactly what Mohammad of Ghazni and Mohammad Ghori did, etc. And we'll break it down from a historical perspective after this.
Sure.
But maybe as a precursor, I want you to address the non-Hindus watching this podcast. Is it fair to say that we are just talking about history as history and not at all about Hindu versus Muslim? Because there is communal tension in the country today. Okay, and I don't want to be a part of that soup. In fact, I want to be the reverse of that soup because of what our country needs geopolitically today, which is unity. If we keep fueling this Hindu-Muslim debate more, you're actually going against what our country needs now and over the next 15 to 20 years.
This has been the same narrative that was seeded about 10 years after independence, that you should not talk about uncomfortable or unsavory truths of Indian history because it is going to offend only one community. I'm not naming any community.
Like Muslims.
Yeah. If you talk about that, that is a narrative. What you said is a variant of a very, very old narrative which began roughly after independence.
I think it's true, sir.
Yeah.
Okay. And I also think that modern Indian Muslims acknowledge whatever happened. And we've had people like A.K. Mohammed come on the show and talk about it. All the Islamic invasions. They don't look at themselves as any different from Indian Hindus. They are also as Indian as you and me.
Fair enough. My point is not that. For every KK Mohammed, I will show you at least 30 Muslim clerics who come on live TV every night on debate. And it's there. Footage is there on YouTube. They will say that Aurangzeb is our hero. He is a role model. They'll say Mahmud of Ghazni is a role model. So, how many KK Mohammeds versus whose voice carries more weight within the larger community? We're talking about the truth, right? Does KK Mohammed's voice carry weight? Does the late Abdul Kalam president's carry weight? Or does a preacher's voice carry weight?
In my opinion, at least, see, I'm not Muslim. This is based on all my Muslim friends, all the conversations I have in urban centers, as well as a lot of the interior India parts that I visited.
Okay.
You know whose voice carries the most weight? Honestly, Mohammad Siraj and Mohammad Shami, who are the two key fast bowlers for India.
No, that is fine, Ranveer. The point is, when you have these things, Sartan Se Juda, nobody provoked that. You got it? So you have any number of, you know, video clips going around where all these fellows basically openly give out threats, brandish swords, saying that, threatening to cut off the neck of the Prime Minister of India. Which Hindus, you know, has made them speak like this? Nobody. Which brings us to the point of intent and basics. All right. The Hindu side has always been on the defensive, or they have been responders to an unnecessary provocation. 2019, there was the vandalization and the destruction of the Murti of Durga in Chandni Chowk in Delhi. Nobody provoked that. No Hindu provoked that. So, see, when you talk about this communal thing and all that, you have to essentially compare the fundamentals. There is an extraordinary book called Riots and Wrongs, which has documented almost all the Hindu-Muslim riots that have occurred in India over the last nearly 300 years. It is a very revealing book. Maybe we can have a discussion on that some other day. But this is a point. The Hindu side has always responded. The other side has always provoked.
we've had people on the show who have exactly the polar opposite opinion.
I'll be happy to debate with them.
Okay, yeah. That's a fair opinion. Because there's no chance that I'll be able to debate with you on this. Mm. Because I'm a podcast, I'm the host of the show. But maybe a fair argument about the whole Hindu-Muslim thing is when there is someone from the other side talking to you and your scholarly material will be against his scholarly material.
Certainly, we can
do that. But from my standpoint, after doing like more than 500 podcasts, I don't completely agree with you because I've heard opinions from all sides.
Then I'll give you a reading list. Maybe we can expand on this discussion in the next episode.
Okay, okay, cool, fair. Which is also why, while I'm a student of history, and I totally believe that the invasions that happened before colonialism began have ruined a lot of things for our country. And I would also go as far as saying have killed off a lot of the love that Hindus have for Hinduism.
Yes.
Fair to say?
Not love. I would say especially Hindus throughout northern India, parts of what is today known as Pakistan and Afghanistan, they were all part of India.
Yeah, I mean...
So no trace of Hindu dharma survives there.
Yeah, fair.
You will not find a single temple of classical origin in that entire region.
Yeah. So as a student of history, seeing it very objectively, of course it hurts me as a Hindu.
Yes.
You know that my own culture, my own ancestors have gone through this.
Yes.
My own ancestors were raped and pillaged, etc. But I have to have social responsibility as a modern media professional with this kind of a following.
Mm.
So I always fear talking a little bit about the invasion
this
side
topic,
of things.
Yeah.
Because, so I mean, I think, you know what we were talking about, how you've dedicated 30 years to it.
Mm.
You've dedicated 30 years to one subject, which is why you talk about it with as much passion. And I want to bring it out.
Okay.
But I do a lot of other subjects as well.
Yes, I've watched some of your episodes. Yeah.
So I see it from a political viewpoint. I see it from a geopolitical viewpoint where we have international viewers who will get this impression of India. And honestly, the more you talk about Islamic invasions, whether we like it or not, it is going to fuel Hindu-Muslim tension in this country.
No, I won't. Again, this falls in the realm of received opinion. Because unless you don't understand history... If you don't know where you came from, you won't know where you're going.
Okay.
It's as simple as that.
Okay.
It's as simple as that.
Okay.
Now, what would you attribute? There is a remote village in Malappuram in Kerala. Entrance of the village, there is a huge signboard saying that this is a Islamic village. Only the Islamic law applies here. Okay. Non-Muslims are discouraged from entering here. Signboard in a village. It is on Indian soil under the rule of Indian constitution, subject to Indian laws. How do you explain this without understanding history and without understanding the fundamentals of what makes a village do this?
Okay, fair.
So if the conclusion that you draw from this is that this will somehow affect Hindu-Muslim, whatever, it will cause communal tension, then I think we'll have to re-examine the fundamentals of logical reasoning itself.
Okay. I mean, I'm speaking on behalf of all the conversations I've had with people my age. Okay. And once again, I'll ask you the same question, that before we move into actually breaking down the Islamic invasion.
Sure.
Talk to the young Muslim watching this podcast.
It's simple. Ask this young Muslim to honestly read and understand the fundamentals of his own faith, unaided by, you know, preachers or anybody. Just as he would study a textbook, a physics textbook or something. You use your logical faculty. Read the fundamentals of his faith. Okay. Compare it with where it stands on the plane of rationality and logic and reasoning. Then the truth will become evident to that Muslim.
Okay. I don't agree with you here, but I will let you continue.
As simple as that.
Yeah. Okay. And I don't agree with you because I have not read the Quran myself.
You should.
Okay. Fair.
You should.
Fair.
Yeah.
And I don't know enough about Islam because I've not grown up in an Islamic family. I'm
Neither have I grown up in Islam.
Which is why I don't think you have the right to fully comment on this.
Is a very old debate which, you know, this is a line which is one of those instruments used to prevent a logical scrutiny of Islam. This was the same line that the church and the Pope in medieval Europe used to prevent a rational, critical scrutiny of the Bible, of the fundamentals of Christianity. Both these faiths are cut from the same cloth.
Okay. Maybe.
So the moment anybody critically scrutinized Christianity there, what was the result? Stonings, public beheadings, what is known as witch burning, and imprisoning. You know how Galileo was hounded? Why? They didn't go out with swords to kill those, anybody, no. They simply questioned the rational and logical basis for both the Old Testament and New Testament, the foundations of Christianity. Look what happened.
Okay.
The world has become better for that.
Okay, sir.
All right. So who are the people who did that? People from the same Christian religion.
Okay.
They questioned it. So let the internal reform begin from this. Each time when the argument comes up that non-Muslims and non-Christians, because they are non-Muslims or non-Christians, they don't have a right to scrutinize the books of the teachings of their religion. But it is the same teachings which impel their followers to either convert or kill the followers of other religions. Yeah.
And I have respect for the life that you have lived, dedicating yourself to studying. But if you and me as Hindu men comment on someone else's faith, it's the equivalent of a Jewish person saying, "Are Ram ji told Sita to commit sati."
It's not the same.
I think it's
same. It's a false equivalence.
Exactly.
No, it's a false equivalence.
That's what they would say about you.
No. Now, fine, I'll grant you that.
Yeah.
Their fundamentals tell us to abuse Ram and Sita in the vilest terms. Their fundamentals tell them, teach them, saying that an idol has to be broken because it is against, you know, whatever their God or whatever other things they have. So are you telling me that here is a question of my survival? Their books tell them to do this to me. And you are telling me that I shouldn't read, you know, my suffering is a result of those books. And you are telling me not to read them because as a non-Muslim or a non-Christian, you're not supposed to read it because you can't understand it. You're not qualified. It doesn't work like that, sir.
I mean, see, I'll tell you what I feel. I don't think that anyone should completely rely on a book as the complete compass for their life.
Without book, both these religions don't exist. Kitab plays a central role in their faith.
100%.
Yeah.
But not all Muslims and Christians fully listen to the book because they understand the truth about modern society.
This is, to an extent, I'll grant this to a good extent to, you know, Christianity, but not Islam.
Okay. At least the Muslims that I know, and we've had some Muslim scholars on the show as well.
Sure.
This is not whitewashing all Muslims and all Christians all over the world. I'm not saying that Hinduism or Sanatan Dharma is better than or worse than any religion. But in India, in our culture, we have the freedom to debate, which is why even this is happening.
So you're actually making my case for me.
I 100% agree with you here. That this is one beautiful thing about our ancient culture, that we are not given one book and told that this is how life is, which is what allows us to expand a little bit. But in saying that, here the underlying argument is address a modern day Indian Muslim who loves India as much as you and me, not all Islamic people all over the world, all over history. So I personally feel that again, whenever we have these Hindu versus Muslim conversations, we are not being socially responsible based on the modern geopolitical truths that's around
India. No, I don't
understand.
You know, these are very, very general terms. And you say socially responsible, things like that. When it, the question is about your survival. All right? So why is it the responsibility of only one community to be, in quotes, what you call socially responsible? Why doesn't the water flow from the other side?
I'll tell you why. Have you seen Border? And in the end of Border,
no,
the
let's
film...
let's not go into movies. I cinema is the worst yardstick for any debate.
Fine. I'll tell you why. It's a, if we're truly talking about why it's a responsibility of Hindus and Hinduism, because this is what we learned from Yudhishthir, Arjun, Bhim,
no, we didn't learn this.
Sahadev and Nakul.
No, we didn't learn this.
I personally feel we did.
We learned strength. We didn't learn apologetics.
We also didn't learn... to oppress people from other faiths. We learned to accept. And we learned from the Mahabharata that you need to adjust Hinduism based on the times that you live in.
To an extent, yes. But, you know, you're trying to connect many disjointed threads which don't, you know, which cannot make, which can't come together like that.
Okay.
In the fashion you describe.
I want to give a base layer. I'm not trying to win an argument against you. I'm trying to come to a narrative before we enter the historical Islamic invasions conversation.
Okay.
So there is no me versus you here.
No,
sir,
definitely not.
Okay.
Yeah,
disagreements build better podcasts. And podcasting has reached a point now where, sir, if I just allow you to expand on the history that you have read, I'll be doing injustice to my audience, which has heard a lot of this on the show already. So I need to get fresher content. I need to challenge myself and you to reach that fresher content.
Sure. Okay.
And the audiences help the podcast evolve. We have both pro-Modi, anti-Modi, Hindus, non-Hindus watching the show. So we have to address everyone here. We can't just address the Hindus as I did 2 years ago. Because I was also learning all the stuff you're talking about for the first time. But I have a lot more perspective now. Which is what's making me like ask you these questions.
Okay.
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 Let's go on. So again, if you want to debate, I can go on for another hour.
We can do that.
We won't expand on the historical conversation.
Sure, go ahead. Yeah.
So would you like to expand on the historical conversation?
Your
or do you,
you can steer it any which way you want.
Just address the young Indian Muslim.
No, I told you, no. That's my only prescription.
Okay.
Let him or her read the fundamentals with an open mind of his own religion, with an open mind. See where it leads to him.
Okay.
Fair. Honesty is the best policy. As simple as that. I have no, you know, I'm not inimical to anybody. What are truths are truths.
Okay.
Whether I like it or not is separate. That's where my, you know, bias and other things come
in. Fair. And I'm sure that there are non-Hindus who say the same about you also.
Yeah,
like
but yeah, let them.
Yeah. But
so
that's
the point. You keep an open mind.
Okay.
Don't begin with a preconceived notion before you study these things.
Okay.
All right. So that is the point. What is it that leads to violence, you know, this kind of thing? Why does it emanate from only one community? And why are Hindus as victims of that violence? Should always be accommodating, should always, you know, to use your Yudhishthira analogy, adapt to these times. At what cost? No Hindu, you will not see a Hindu unless he's a hardened criminal or something, with the, which is a different thing. All right. The fundamentals of his religion won't teach him to behave like this. That is a point.
You're saying the fundamentals of Islam teach them to be
yes.
violent?
That's why message
that's
that.
Very generalized, sir.
It is true, sir.
If that was the case, Abdul Kalam, Zakir Khan,
so
Muhammad
they,
Siraj, all
correct,
these guys would be violent.
Correct. So they, no. They are exceptions.
No, that's, then it's not a generalized.
They are exceptions. I'm speaking on the strength of, strength of what the history of Islam, not just in India, throughout the world.
Okay.
This has been the behavior pattern.
I think, honestly, there's many people who will agree with you in the world. Okay.
Then I have to see what, you know, their scholarship is.
Okay. I personally disagree with you as a young Indian. And I have a different message to the young Muslims
then
watching
I'll,
this.
Then I'll give you my reading list.
Your?
A reading list. Yeah.
Done. I'll bring a reading list from the Muslim side.
Please,
also.
Please.
Okay. Because
we'll
that's
see,
what podcasts
no, we'll
are.
See that after that debate, we'll come, we'll both agree.
Let's move on to the Islamic invasions.
Certainly.
I am detaching myself from the Islamic invasion narrative based on the modern young Indian Muslims.
Okay.
I segregate the two aspects.
Okay.
You know, I'll tell you what. I personally feel that if we attach whatever happened during the Islamic invasions to the modern day Muslim, it's the equivalent of saying all the white people in USA were slave owners and, you know, have affected the black community a lot, which is actually what's happening in the USA today. And the USA is fully kind of divided as a community. That country is suffering. I don't want the same to happen to my country. Because for me, I love being Hindu, but I'm Indian before I'm Hindu.
Okay.
So, which is why now I will let you continue about the Islamic
invasions. You are an Indian before a Hindu.
100%.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Next
and,
topic.
And I'm the most Hindu that I know my age.
Okay.
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 But let's go on. You're Islamic invasions. Let's talk about the story.
Okay.
Okay. Why don't we begin with what happened pre-Islamic invasions in India? Like in terms of what was the landscape, the culture of all Indians at that point in the subcontinent. And by subcontinent, I also mean Pakistan. I also mean Afghanistan. Why don't you draw out a cultural, historical, geographical map as well as an economic map, as well as a kind of blueprint about what went wrong that these invasions became successful. Because technically, the winners of war write history. So we were the losers of war in that period. If we lost war, there was something that went wrong on our side. It's like losing a cricket game and then you go back to say that, oh, between overs 20 and 30, we didn't do this.
Okay.
So highlight that also. Because it's important to study history from a psychological perspective so that history doesn't repeat itself.
Sure. That's a lot of ground you've asked me to cover.
Feel free wherever.
So broadly speaking, India had external invasions before Islam. The earliest recorded is by Alexander. Then the Hunas came in, Huns, Shakas came in, Pahlavis came in. So multiple guys came. But they did not do significant damage, one. Two, they were all pre-Islamic invasions, which means the faith called Islam had not yet been born in this world.
Okay.
All right.
Same geographical
and area. And the Greek invasions began even before Christianity had begun, had taken root, even in the West. So they didn't do significant damage to us. Due to various factors, we had extraordinarily strong kingdoms and the modes of travel, climate, weather, all those Hindu Kush mountains and then the Karakoram Pass. It was very hostile territory. The Himalayas, even today, it is still our natural fortress. All right. So on the socio-religious cultural landscape, it was a rather homogeneous society in one sense. You had different schools of which were the offshoots of Hindu Dharma itself. Mainly the Vaidika school and second the Buddhist school. And you know, much later you had other schools like Shakta, Shaiva, Vaishnava. Much later they came. So this was roughly the socio-religious landscape. Now on the economic landscape, India was the world's largest economy. Okay, second only to China. Sometimes the equations would change roughly here and there. Now, on the political side, we were characterized by, you know, sweeping empires under one king. It could be, it began with Chandragupta Maurya, and then followed by Satavahanas, Guptas, all these sweeping large empires as big as some 10 European countries. That was the size of one empire, ruled by one monarch. So this was roughly the political thing. And there was cultural unity in the sense that although the Hindu mind, there was no non-Hindu influence in that sense by that time. So the Hindu mind had always had a sense of India's geographical borders and they were united culturally, which is still the case today. Why would someone, you're familiar with Panchang, right? Almanac, Hindu calendar.
Okay. Yeah.
So what does it contain? It contains a list of, you know, various festivals, tithis and, you know, everything. Let's take the case of Ganesh Chaturthi. You are in Bombay. So across India, this festival is celebrated different. Here, the importance is too much. So, you check out the Panchang, what it says on Ganesh Chaturthi. Where all it is celebrated, not just in Maharashtra, but across India. All the famous Ganesha temples on this day, kaunsa utsav hoga, and why it is done. So, this shows your cultural unity in the sense of both geography, space and time. Time as festival, indicated by a day of the festival. Space in different parts of India. So, this was always there in our psyche. It is still there. So why should I go to a Tirthyatra in, say, Ujjain? Because there is no mandir in Bangalore. Hai na? Why should I go to Ujjain? Or why should I go to Rameshwaram? Or why should somebody staying in Jalandhar come all the way till Kanchipuram? Right? Why should the sari for Kamakhya Devi temple in Assam, till date it is stitched in Kanchipuram? So which law, which rule book tells you to do this, which created this system? The Purohit in Pashupatinath temple in Nepal, he comes from South Canara in Karnataka. Compulsory. So, if you next time you go there, you speak to him in Kannada, he'll reply to you in Kannada. So, which system created this? What created this? So, it is what is known as sadhana, tapasya. It is a long process of trial and error and, you know, a profound kind of evolution. So, this was the cultural landscape back then. All right? Political ho gaya, cultural ho gaya, economic ho gaya. Then, what was the other thing? Something else you asked.
Psychological.
Psychological is, I wouldn't use that word psychological, but this was how it was roughly spread. Okay. What we also did was that, I don't like to use this term, but since it is fashionable now, I'll use it. India was the greatest exporter of culture.
True.
When our businessmen went out in caravans, they took Hindu culture with them. And wherever they went, they told stories from India, from Jataka stories, from Hitopadesha, from Panchatantra, from Ramayana, Mahabharata, Vishnu Purana, Bhagavatam. Wherever they went, even in the Middle East, you see, you trace the history of folklore in Persia, Turkey, Middle East, you will find a Hindu element there. So this has happened more than minimum 2000 years ago. It was a continuous exchange. Until, you know, Islam cut it off. This used to be there, and what is known today as Southeast Asia. There the influence, it is an extension counter of Hindu culture, actually speaking. What made this possible? Unless you have this kind of political power, which is also an enlightened political power, you don't need swords to go out and kill and conquer and then, you know, impose your culture. Two ways to do this, right? One is, you know, chop off and then convert or, you know, forcibly impose your culture on an unwilling population. Or you do this. You have your secure borders, you're secure in a political kingdom, power, you know, how to defend your borders from both internal and external threats. And then culture automatically spreads itself. Even China, till date, it hates India for a reason that, you know, without firing a single shot, without throwing a single sword, India culturally conquered China. A lot of Chinese medicine owes to a 2nd century AD Ayurvedic text named Navaneetakam. So then when Islam, you know, began to make inroads throughout the world, we were also kind of complacent in a sense.
Like didn't take action.
We
to
didn't
defend.
Take them too seriously.
Okay.
In that sense. Plus, we didn't actually, Hindu kings back then, fail to study the real nature of this new invader.
So you're saying the invaders before? We had already defeated. So we assume that this is one more external invader.
One more external invader. Who's also like them.
Okay.
And a lot of those pre-Islamic invaders were assimilated into Hindu society.
like the Huns and
Hunas, Shakas, okay. Greeks and all that. So we also thought this was something similar to that. And realistically, they didn't have it very easy. You know, Islamic invaders from to reach Delhi, from Ghazni to Delhi or from Sindh to Delhi. Sindh is the starting point. So when Qasim comes in, from Qasim's raid into Sindh in 712 and he leaves in 715, from then to establishing a firm foothold in Delhi, it took about 320 years. Why? Because Sindhus never gave up fighting.
Hmm.
They didn't have it easy, unlike, you know, in other parts of the world. So within 40 years after, you know, Muhammad died, all of Egypt was swallowed by Islam, and, you know, they touched the borders of Spain. Then, they were ravaging Europe. So entire Middle East was, conquered by Islam within 40 years of Prophet Muhammad's death. From Muhammad bin Qasim's maiden raid into Sindh, till the time that Muslims established a political foothold in Delhi, it took about 320 years. And throughout that, they met with fierce resistance at every step. Now think about this. After Qasim, Muhammad bin Qasim was an Arab Muslim.
You'll also have to thoda give context on him. Who was he? Where did he come from?
Okay.
And roughly what year?
Okay. So Qasim came into India. He raided India in 712 CE. And he was in India for about 3 years, less than 3 years. Then he goes back to Iraq, Baghdad.
Modern day Iraq.
Baghdad. So Baghdad at that time was one of the greatest centers or one of the greatest hubs of the rapidly rising Muslim political power in that belt, that region of the world. So it was also known as the global hub of Islamic culture at that time. And it retained its preeminence for about 2 or 3 centuries, after which Chinggis Khan comes. And then he completely devastates Baghdad. And later, Chinggis Khan still has, he arouses a lot of hatred even today in the Muslim world. At the time when, you know, they thought that Islam would take over the whole world, this fellow comes, short man, with a huge army of Mongols and devastates and pretty much decimates whatever territories that Islam had conquered. And the Mongols go all the way up to Egypt also. That's another story. And his grandson, another Mongol named Hulagu Khan, he repeats the same thing 2 generations or 3 generations later.
Sacks Baghdad.
Sacks Baghdad again. In fact, the decimation is so brutal that there are graphic descriptions which I can't, repeat in this show.
You can actually.
I can. Okay, yeah. Fine. The whole city is razed. Forts are burned down. Men, women, children, infants, they are all... basically, what the Mongols do is that they gave the taste of what Islam had done to them in a much more ferocious manner.
One second. When did Islam... Like, when Chinggis Khan and...
Chinggis Khan came around early 12th century.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then there was... few battles that the Muslim world won against the Mongols.
No, before that, in Central Asia, Islam had touched all the way till Central Asia.
Okay.
So Afghanistan and Upper, that Chinese region, which is where you still find, this Muslim Uyghur province in China. The Muslims are in substantial numbers. It dates back all this to this period. Anyway, so that's why I say we have to read history.
Sure.
To understand the present and future. Anyway. So that happens. And Qasim, he's called back to Baghdad. And, pretty much the regime changes there in Baghdad. Incidentally, Muhammad bin Qasim, he's deputed to invade India by his uncle and father-in-law. Okay, jo chacha bolte hai na, he's also his father-in-law. And he says, you know, you have to invade Hind. I'm giving you a fleet of 6,000 boats, you know, warships, and, you know, go. That's how it begins. And he goes back there. But by then, the regime has changed in Baghdad. And his uncle has been deposed and killed. And the hostile party, the person who was deposed, Al-Hajjaj, that's Qasim's uncle's name. That fellow is in power. So Qasim is recalled there. He's imprisoned. He's skinned alive and killed in a gruesome manner. So this kind of warfare, this kind of politics is unknown to India until that time. This kind of, you know, all-out warfare where there are no rules but only victory at any cost. So he goes back there. Between him and Mahmud of Ghazni, there is a gap of about 2.5 centuries. So 715 is when Qasim goes back to Baghdad. And 1000 CE is when Mahmud comes into India. He begins his first raid.
Okay.
So you see about 2.5 centuries of gap.
You know, parallelly, if we speak about what's happening in India at this time, or even if we kind of precede this period, roughly when was Ashoka and Chandragupta?
This is way back, yeah. Ashoka, they lived BCE, okay. What is known as BC, you know, before Christ.
Okay.
Now it's called BCE, meaning so, before Common Era.
So I'm painting that whole phase from Chandragupta and Ashoka up till the point that we've reached
up
in our time.
Up till Qasim is about 1,500 years.
Wow, okay. But in this whole 1,500-year period, you know, I mean, from this whole Ashoka period, we hear about Kalinga War and how that war was so brutal that it changed Ashoka's mindset and all. We've had someone come on the show and say that, no, actually, that anyway, that's a whole other conversation about just Ashoka. But in this whole 1,500-year period, there were no civil wars in India, or there weren't warring factions or anything?
Okay. So when you say civil wars, it's a very good question, Randy. When you say civil war and fractional war or factional war, a civil war, what is a civil war? It is the breakdown of government. Right? Basically, a civil war is anarchy. Depending on the intensity, depending on the duration, it is basically anarchy. The degrees might vary. So this is why the existence of a government is so vital in any civilization, right? When government breaks down, or when the government is so weak that the citizens, you know, they take the law into their own hands and say, look, we don't need you. That is when a civil war also happens, all right? Now, in the technical sense of the word, as we understand civil war as anarchy, it never existed in India, in Indian history.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, fine. Let's rewrite it as state versus state wars.
Okay, so what you're talking about is, this question comes from what is known as the modern democratic mind. State versus state. You're talking about a period of entirely composed of monarchies, of rulers, kings. Technically, in a democracy, there is no king. There is an elected representative, right? He's a first among equals. He becomes a PM and things like that. Now, for this mind, to understand how a monarchy operates is very, very hard, if not impossible.
Okay. See, I'll tell you where I'm getting with this. We're talking about that Islamic invasion point. My original question was, what went wrong in India for those invasions to become successful over time? Because the narratives I've got on the show are that it became a little you versus me even then. And this is with Abhijit Chawda, with a bunch of the other historians that we've spoken about. There was some lack of unity, say, between the Rajputs and whoever was ruling in Madhya Pradesh or Maharashtra or the rest of the country. There was some lack of unity, possibly because of this whole narrative about hard men build soft times build soft men, and soft men build hard times. So we're at that hard times point when we're talking about India getting invaded, which is preceded by soft men, which...
No. I don't know where you're getting this from, but...
Every historian on the show has said this.
No. It didn't work quite like that. There are many reasons for this.
Okay.
I think I mentioned about the complacency of Hindu kings.
Yeah, so soft men. This is what I'm talking
about.
Not
even soft men. So the man who was responsible for allowing Qasim to succeed was a Hindu king named Raja Dahir. He was ruling in the Makran coast, which is, Makran is now in Pakistan.
Karachi.
His capital was a city named Debal. So this is where he entered. All the invasions prior to Qasim had taken place through the land route, through the mountain passes in Afghanistan, you know, all that. And they were easily beaten back. The terrain is so difficult. It is so tough. And you don't know, the invaders didn't know the lay of the land, so to speak, then the weather and preparedness, a lot of things. So they were beaten back. 4 or 6 invasions, attempts like that were beaten back. So Hajjaj said, okay, let's try the sea route this time. And all the 4 invasions before that, Dahir had repulsed them. So this time, this fellow comes with an even better preparedness, with a larger force. And Dahir by then has become complacent. That is one factor. The second factor were the Buddhists, a section of Buddhists, not all of them, a section of Buddhists who were carrying out, who were passing on intelligence about Dahir to Al-Hajjaj and his officers there, and his spies. That, you know, we don't want to live under this fellow. There is one theory that Dahir was an oppressive person, but that theory finds not much support in through evidence. But whatever, this is the Buddhist correspondence, you know, their what is known as backstabbing, supplying valuable intelligence. It is a big factor, actually. It is a big factor.
As in... the Buddhists
yeah,
facilitated the entry.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. By passing on information. I mean, okay. They didn't open the gates or whatever, but they, what does an invader look like, you know, look for? He wants to know geography. He wants to know the troop strength of his victim. He wants to know the local conditions. He wants to know where they can camp. All these real world things. And then, obviously, on the military side, he wants to know the vulnerabilities.
All right.
Ki, where are the vulnerable points? What is the public opinion about this king? These are all, you know, you act on this intelligence. Even today, that is what happens in diplomacy and things like that.
Okay.
So, combined factors plus Dahir's own complacency, he was so foolish that he allowed Muhammad bin Qasim to pitch his tent 60 kilometers away or 60 miles away or quite close to his fortress. Who does this? It's an overconfidence. Ki pehle isko haraya tha, abhi hara sakte hai.
This is what I'm asking.
Yes.
Like in terms of what did those soft men do to...
No, if he was a soft man, that is what I'm saying. If he was a soft man, he wouldn't have repulsed the Arabic invasions, you know, 4 times. Huh? Ek overconfidence aata hai ki, you know, I am... so tough, I'm so strong, you know, nobody can defeat me.
I think hard men would just be invincible to, like, invasions.
Perhaps, yeah. Perhaps.
But my question is, what led to him becoming a soft man? Is it because India was so rich that it was that whole nepotism problem, that rich kids can't play the game as well?
No. You can't use this logic here. It's simply a case of complacency, Ranveer.
I would still categorize complacency also as rich kid problems.
No, okay, rich kid problem is not complacency. The guy who goes up, you know, the hard way. Example, you know, forget Dahir. Take an example, you know, you grow up from the scratch, you build your own life, reach a certain stage of what you call invincibility. And all along you see both victory and defeat, but then you get to that point because your victories have been greater than your defeats. And even at that point, you're continuously challenged. And there is a saying, right? You have to run twice as fast to remain in the same place.
Okay.
So you're used to, you know, dealing with difficulty and, you know, beating back your opponents. So that breeds a certain sense of confidence in what you call as these hard men. But what is the line? What is a thin line that separates confidence from overconfidence?
You tell me.
No, there's the person who has understood that line would never know defeat, no.
Okay. Maybe so breaking away from this Dahir king, I'm also asking a more generalized question about all of our country.
Mm.
Like, how did so much of the country, especially North India, get taken over? Was it repeats of the same King Dahir situation where there was traitors, where there was, say again, rich kid kings, kings who had become old or complacent, etc.? Or was there more to it?
Yes, all of the above.
All these factors came together.
All of the above, but they didn't come together. You have to take these things case by case. Okay. Dahir was complacent. That is one thing. Now, say in the case of Mahmud's raid of Somnath, right? It was a very prosperous and a very strong city, but it was unguarded. A bunch of citizens and a few soldiers were protecting Somnath. That's all it was to, you know. It was pretty much a cakewalk for Mahmud in that sense. Then, because right in the neighborhood, you had an extraordinarily powerful king called Paramara Bhoja. In fact, after Mahmud demolished Somnath and looted the whole, you know, plundered the whole place, he was scared of the confederacy of Paramara Bhoja. So he had to take a desert route and reach Ghazni, return to Ghazni after a lot of hardship. So what prevented? The question is, what allowed Mahmud, who or what allowed Mahmud to even reach all the way till Somnath in the first place? Bhoja was, by any standard, by any measure, extremely powerful king compared to Mahmud. Complacency, not for the lack of strength or will. Negligence.
Yeah.
And in case of Mohammed Ghori, a traitor, it was a victory of perfidy.
Okay.
And with a lot of other things, internal traitors, other Hindu kings, lack of unity in facing a common alien enemy. So a lot of these factors, like you said.
Few things. One, I actually want to hear a little more details about Mohammed of Ghazni and Mohammed of Ghori separately. So we'll cover those stories as well.
Okay.
Secondly, the one thing I know about history is that it repeats itself.
Yes.
And I think the British knew that as well. They had someone telling them that, listen, this country has been invaded because divide and rule worked back then also. So you guys should just enhance that.
I wouldn't quite put it that way, but... roughly speaking, in a sense, yes.
Okay. Yeah. Like, there was possibly a lack of unity back then. If all those state kings or kings from different tribes, etc.
Regions
would have come together, maybe we would have been able to put up a fight.
Absolutely.
Okay.
No. Individual kings put up fight. Together... So there is, you know, the clearest way to explain this. There are two terms in our languages. Ek hai rashtra, right? Dusra hai desha. Rashtra is what is India. Whole of India as one indivisible political, social, cultural unit. Okay, that is rashtra. Rashtra is this indivisible political cultural unit called India. There is Desha, for example, Maratha Desha, Karnata Desha, which is today's Karnata, Gurjar Desha, which is Gujarat, so Kalinga Desha, Odisha, parts of that, Vanga Desha, Anga, like that. So these are regions which were also political dominions within the larger Rashtra.
Empire.
Not an empire, country, nation.
Okay. Okay.
India as a nation, these are all regions which have independent kings ruling, you know, some parts of it.
What's uniting them?
Absolute monarchical control. And so, you know, wars are fought between them for expanding the boundaries of each their respective desha. And so we never lost sight of that. But what happened over the period is what I call... the loss of the Aryavarta consciousness.
Do you think that's what united all these guys?
Which one?
The Aryavarta consciousness.
Yes, yes.
Is what kept everyone together.
Kept everyone together. Okay. So they would not interfere. They recognize the suzerainty of the other king. Okay. See, you were you are a Chola monarch. All right, I'm a Chalukya monarch. We have clear boundaries. And the only time we go to war is when you encroach my boundaries or vice versa. Okay, or there is some kind of a skirmish and, you know, the king has to intervene. Or the other way is to declare a Digvijaya, a war of expansion, territorial conquest.
As in there were rules related to war.
Very codified, very logical, codified rules related.
All of what we would term as Akhand Bharat today followed back then. Everyone had rules related to war. Yeah. And there was a code of conduct.
There was a code of conduct. Now, here is another data point that will help you, you know, understand this much better. Now, you had different political kingdoms, entities, Chola and, say, Pallava, within the same geographical unit, all right? During peacetime, I am your enemy, you are my enemy, all right? Now, Reliance has a plant in my kingdom. And he also wants to set up a plant in your kingdom. He has to obviously take permission from me, which I will grant freely. So will you. The rivalry is purely political between you and me, between our armies, not the rest of the society. Sure. Not the people, who follow different sects, not the businessmen who want to carry on trade and establish factories and things like that. The war is enmities only between you and me. It is political. These are some of the, when you think about it, it's made for a lot of political stability. Although you had, you know, these separate kingdoms, but overall there was stability in society, culture, things like that. Now, I'll take another random example. There's one businessman called Kunjan Ambi Shetty. He was his native was somewhere in Kerala. And he had business, he was running a mobile business, not mobile phone, but caravan type of business, dealing in precious metals and gems and pearls, things like that. So he had extensive shopping outlets, establishments, basically in the Hoysala kingdom, in the Sevuna kingdom or Yadava kingdom, which is in Devagiri, Dalatabad, there with that kingdom, with the Pandya kingdom. So three or four kingdoms, he had free passage. And all the kings out there, they treated him as an honored guest because he contributed to their economy.
God. Let's go back to the
So this is the, this was the state of the thing. But the moment they lost this Aryavarta consciousness and began squabbling with each other for no reason, for very silly reasons, as you know, water sharing or some farmer, some zamindar, he set off his cows to graze into the enemy land. Iske liye, a lot of, you know, petty reasons, they began to fight with each other. And this factor of revenge ki, mere baap ko isne mara, iske bete ko main marunga. So many wars were fought just like that.
Rich kid problems.
So this kind of nonsense kept on. Then over the period, they lost sight of this Aryavarta consciousness.
Unity.
So they lost sight of this. Second was the disappearance of what I call, you know, this Samrat or Chakravarti. So Chandragupta Maurya, he was the first Chakravarti in that sense. And all the way up to the Gupta dynasty. The end of Gupta dynasty pretty much finished it off. That changed our history. It made India vulnerable to that extent. And with the fall of Harshavardhana, of Kanyakubja, Kanauj, that put an end to this concept of Samrat. Like a man who single-handedly rules. With that, you had these independent, all the vassals under Harshavardhana. All the vassals began to declare independence. And then they began to, fight with each other to expand their kingdom or all kinds of reasons.
Can we take a small pause from history?
Yeah.
Because it's the nature of the show.
Yes.
And again, our viewers and listeners, as much as I understand them, are very modern, kind of in this whole polymath zone, which is why I'm breaking away from history. And history will still be the focus of our conversation. But this whole debate we were having before about like Hindu-Muslim unity, I was having it because of this reason. That whatever we're talking
I'm
about...
I'm coming to that.
Has, I'll just put my point across.
It'll lead to that.
Yeah. Like, this is a version... Like what we are talking about is breakage of Aryavarta consciousness. Is a version of what is kind of happening today with the country, where the country is becoming fragmented based on religious lines. Because I don't think that... there is any difference between me as an Indian Hindu in this country and an Indian Muslim friend of mine who's grown up in a similar societal structure. So I was born and raised in Wadala, Mumbai. I have Muslims who were born and raised there. Thought process is similar. Love for India is similar. And history repeats itself. So if history is truly to repeat itself, we are on the brink of another invasion. Perhaps this time not by another religion. Perhaps this time by another country. Perhaps this time by another psychology. Perhaps this time by something like another ideology, which is what's happened in America. That country is being broken down because of a lack of unity. I just don't want that to happen in my country, which is why I want to promote Hindu-Muslim unity a lot in the modern day. Fair to say?
Fair to say, except that the foundation of unity should be based on an acceptance of the past and a reconciliation and a kind of promise to see that we don't go back to those days.
As in, you're saying the...
It has to be on the foundation of honesty. The best example for this, you can see in Germany. Okay, where throughout Europe, and I think if I'm not mistaken, even in America, generally in the West, denying the Holocaust is a criminal offense. And Germany itself has erected several monuments that narrates the complete gory details of the targeted genocide of Jews for the simple reason that they were Jews.
Okay.
The Nazis, you know, and they made an oath to themselves after World War II that this country will ensure that no ideology like Nazism, you know, is ever born again.
Got it. So what you're trying to say, I think, is the Indian Muslim needs to accept that, yes, this happened and not deny it.
Yes.
That's what pisses you off.
Yes. No, it doesn't piss me off. The point is that if they keep denying this, it will repeat again.
Okay, as in that
if
is
they, if they think,
okay,
see, one thing is you accept the truth and say sorry and, you know, take a solemn promise not to repeat that. Nobody has a problem, one. But on the contrary, if you do two things, one is to deny that it ever happened. Two is to feel proud that, you know, our ancestors did this to you.
Okay. Again, I don't think all Muslims feel proud. Of course, there's good and bad people in every society.
Sir, nobody is speaking about all Muslims. So here is the thing. You and I are having this show.
Yeah.
Why doesn't a Muslim even think like this? I'm not saying all Muslims, but your average general person. Why can't he or she feel that, you know, we also owe something on these lines? Okay. We are also as equally responsible for maintaining what you call as this harmony and this social responsibility.
Okay.
I never see these voices on TV.
Okay.
I never see these voices in mainstream.
I agree with you here that we don't hear all this too much. But another way of looking at it is maybe it begins from this podcast. That this message is going to go out to them.
I don't know, sir. I'm not a social reformer. I'm not a... I don't speak on anybody's behalf.
Okay.
I live a very, very simple life with a few convictions.
I'm an engineer, so I think of a solution-oriented mindset.
Okay.
Like rather than just like leaving it as tension.
It's very dangerous to speak on the behalf of other people.
Okay.
So there is a thing that why meditation is recommended, why these inward practices are recommended. Because for the duration that you meditate, your problem will not be there for the rest of the world.
Your problem will
not
be
there? You are a problem for the world. So when you withdraw inside, you meaning not you, I include everybody, myself. So for the duration that I am engaged in inward practices, that I remain silent, I don't cause any harm or any change to the world.
Okay. You think Islam is doing that?
Naturally. There's enough evidence, sir.
Okay.
How much more do you need?
Again, we need a Muslim next to you to
Why not?
Have this debate.
We can.
I'm not equipped to.
Certainly.
Okay.
We can.
Again, I do feel that there's good and bad in every society. These are slightly generalized.
The whole universe works very, very hard to make sure that you and I are breathing every moment.
Yeah.
We don't live in a vacuum. We are not born in a vacuum. So an entire creation works overtime to keep us going.
Okay. You know, I'll tell you what I appreciate you for. You do represent a section mm-hmm. of Hindu thought.
Mm-hmm.
And I think these opinions should be out there. Like mm-hmm. we've had Sikh historians mm-hmm. put out their opinion on the Khalistan issue.
Mm.
And if there is anger or angst in a human's heart, especially someone like yourself who's dedicated mm. their life to the study of a subject,
mm-hmm.
I want to give this platform to people like yourself to put out your actual emotion in a very raw way. Mm-hmm. Because that's the beginning of my motivation,
mm-hmm.
which is Indian unity,
mm-hmm.
which is what I think my country needs.
Okay.
Which is why I'm giving you all these questions and debating okay. with you on these things. But you have the complete right to mm-hmm. express yourself mm-hmm. on the show, sir.
Mm-hmm.
And while I know it's dangerous, mm-hmm. all I have to say is risk hai to ishq hai. Mm-hmm. So
there's no danger to us from anyone except ourselves. I'm telling you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Would you like to go back to the timeline?
Yeah. So where had we left this thing? With
the
Aryavarta consciousness.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when they lost that, you lose a certain sense of vitality. And then, you know, all this skirmishes kept happening. You win some, you lose some. But what they had not, which has been, I think, one of the greatest failure on the Hindu society community, was the failure to study the core doctrines of Islam. It is one thing to invade, not that, you know, wars weren't happening, like I said, with mutually warring Hindu kings, but none of them destroyed temples. None of them slaughtered cows. None of them had this practice of taking women and children as slaves. Compulsory, then this forced conversions. So slave taking of even infants was a practice that was non-existent in India until Islam came. Mm. So you see the kind of disruption that happens, social cultural disruption that happens, and a lot of valuable things that are lost to your civilization irretrievably. So when Mahmud, you know, plundered and went on a series of raids into India multiple times, he took so many slaves, men, women, and children, so many slaves. Back then, the world had, the medieval world had several lucrative slave trade markets, most notably in the Arabian Peninsula. In Cairo was a big slave market. I think one of the cities in Spain or Belgium that had that belt. That was a very flourishing slave trade market. Turkey was a huge slave trade market. And later Lahore was also one of the world's largest slave trade markets continuously for about 400 years.
Damn. What's the period? All right.
Yeah.
Like four?
400 years, let's say roughly starting from, why 400? Even 600 years actually. Till Aurangzeb's time, or at least till Shah Jahan's time, predated by 500 years or so. 500, 600 years.
And like the slaves would be Lahore. Sourced from all of India.
All of India. Every war in which a Muslim king, a Muslim raider or conqueror became successful would be accompanied by industrial scale slave taking. Men, able-bodied men, women and children, including infants. Okay, and they would be transferred. So when Mahmud took so many slaves, he got letters from merchants, slave merchants in from Baghdad, for example. They wrote to him saying that, look, you're single-handedly destroying the market here with your oversupply of slaves from Hindustan. That is when, you know, Mahmud said, okay, fine, I won't send any more slaves. So who were these slaves? Imagine somebody, the CEO of, say, one of the Tata group of companies. Imagine his wealth, his net worth, his lifestyle, his status in the society. Imagine him being bound and fettered in chains and being sold as a commodity in a market.
Yeah, I'd also recommend everyone watch a movie called 12 Years a Slave. Have you seen this?
Yes, yes.
It's such a psychologically challenging movie.
Very disturbing.
You understand the brutal truths about slavery as well as the brutal truths about human trafficking, which unfortunately happen even today.
Even today it happens, But not on the scale. See, slavery was legal back then. In both Europe and the Islamic world, it was legal.
Okay.
Even in America, which is why civil war happened. So anyway, now this disruption, this kind of thing never happened in wars between two Hindu kings.
Got it.
Only soldiers would fight. And they had well-defined rules, a code of honor, a code of war ethics, in which women, children cannot be used as shields. They cannot be used as bait in order to, you know, stop the enemy. You cannot kill cows. You cannot kill farmers, like, you know, non-combatants. All the UN Charter of War and all that thing is some international consensus. All these were there in existence from 5,000-6,000 years here.
Okay. Let's talk about the timeline.
So, this happened. And this was a new warfare which... And think of the disruption that has occurred in one way. Now, prior to these Islamic invasions, none of the alien invaders who had come had engaged in this kind of behavior. So this was completely new. The destruction, disruption, slave taking, all these things, right? That fundamentally altered our society and the course of our history. And yes, you know, the factors are there, disunity among Hindu kings. This, I think that we have covered that ground already. And so as the weakening the of the Aryavarta consciousness, eventually you lose it, then it is as good as a free for all, which also paved the way for the long lasting Mughal rule.
Okay. Yeah. You know what I will say though? I think my generation, at least I would like to believe this, we are the Virat Kohli generation. Okay. Which is a little bolder, a little more aggressive, a little more with a chase for that ultimate excellence and perfection. And that's not to say that your generation is not. It's just that we've been brought up with information around us, which leads to many psychological problems. Overthinking is just the base level of it. What you said, lack of patience, lack of commitment, all that's there. But... my hope is that all you and me can do for future Indians is talk, debate, put out the truth, and do our role. You know, we've dedicated our life to studying. You've studied in your own way. I've studied in my own way. All we can do is talk. I don't think we should be even relying on the government to change certain things about education.
Yeah, sure. I mean,
like, it's just the responsible thing to do.
I guess so. I don't know.
Yeah. One request I have of you is I think you should go on more podcasts.
If I have time, yeah.
Yeah. We'll see. I appreciate your time, sir. Today.
Thank you.
I think we're almost at the end of this conversation. Trust me, I've never had anyone on the show who's so easy to speak to and break down things, especially when there are conflicting opinions. People usually bring their ego into play. People bring, you know, their sense of what they've studied. So you've gained my respect, my team's respect, but also the audience's respect. There are some things you and me on a very fundamental level disagree on, which is the beauty of this conversation.
Okay.
So I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
I invite you back on the show, sir.
Sure.
At some point, I hope like we can do this again in the future.
Definitely.
Again, lots of respect for the work and hours and years you've put into your subject. A lot of respect for you to come down here and talk to a 30-year-old about the subject that you've given. My entire lifespan. So lots of respect, and you've earned a lot of respect from the audience also.
Thank you. Thanks lots so much for inviting me.
I hope it was fun for you.
Very engaging. Thank you.
Okay. Yes. Lots of love, sir. See you soon.
See you.
So that was the conversation for today. What I will request of you guys, especially if this conversation appealed to you, is to be slightly active on social media about TRS, especially when people pick up snippets and then use it to frame either Sandeep sir or myself I hope that the regular listeners of the show, the regular supporters of the show, go on those comment sections, go on social media and talk about this lengthy conversation. That's the issue with social media. People usually end up picking up just one sentence or two sentences from an elaborate conversation and then projecting it as an out of context opinion. There's a lot of context required for these kind of conversations. So I'm really hoping that we get some support from the TRS community. Please tell me what you thought of this slightly fiery episode. I'll definitely bring Sandeep sir back on the show, possibly to debate about other topics. I just wanted to show the audiences an aspect of the kind of conversation we have in urban India today. These are very important conversations for the future of our country, and I hope that you keep supporting TRS, whether you're Hindu, whether you're Muslim, whether you're Christian, whether you're Buddhist, whether you're Jain, whether you're Sikh. Just remember, you're Indian first and foremost, at least according to me. Lots of love to you guys. See you in 3 days.